copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
This is the plan for today. First, why are people afraid of scientists? And then how can we engage with scientists? Like, know about worldview assumptions, know a bit about the limits and the scope of science, and know about the wonders, helpful key questions and answers when discussing with scientists, how you can engage in a meaningful discussion. So why are many Christians afraid of scientists? My experience is that they seem to talk or speak another language. Like, science seems to be extremely successful if we look into our world, in our society. And then there are these claims that science can explain everything, and especially on natural grounds only. Like, for example, here this physical chemist, Peter Atkins. He said, humanity should accept that science has eliminated the justification for believing in cosmic purpose and that any survival of purpose is inspired solely by sentiment. So that's it, you know? Science has explained everything, and if anyone believes that there is some purpose or a purpose giver, let alone a god, a personal god even, if anyone believes that, then it's just caused by his sentiment because he somehow wants to be comforted by such a kind of a god. But there is no rational basis. And of course, if you are hearing this all the time, in the media, in school, in university, then of course you look maybe like this little duck here. One person is always the stupid one, it says here in German. So of course, you will look like the stupid person, or you are the one who is against reason. Or you just... when you hear such a statement by someone sitting next to you in a restaurant or in the mensa, in the refrigeration, in the university, you might realize, well, I don't know how to relate to such a scientist who believes such things. How can I talk at all? I don't have a starting point even to talk with such a person because I think differently. And so quite a few people in the church, in our experience, seem to ignore even scientists or science at all. Like, they are hopeless cases, they are so much immersed in atheism or in naturalism, and in the end, science is irrelevant. It's more about spiritual matters, and we don't know how to talk with those people. And so sometimes they are even seen as unwelcome enemies. Like when I spoke in one church once, someone told me, by the way, there is a scientist from the university here, so be careful, or something like that. And I would say, wow, that's great if they come. I want to engage with them. So I think we can understand these reactions by church people, but I think, of course, they are not biblical, are they? I mean, we are called love your neighbor, and it does not say explicitly in the Bible, but even though your neighbor might be a scientist, so still love a scientist, because scientists are human beings. They have human needs, human longings. Scientists are often lonely. They're often isolated because they are working on very specific issues and deal with very difficult topics and have stress with their professor or with their colleagues and are in competition and always short in time and have a lot of tasks on the agenda, never finishing. So they really are happy usually when there is someone who cares for them or invites them for a dinner or something. And then, of course, scientists often know amazing things. And even though they might not say that, these are amazing things about God's creation. Because if God has created nature, then it is God's creation, whether they know it or whether they don't know it. And so it's interesting to talk to a scientist. A lot of what I what I learned about creation, I learned from atheists, from my professors, or from fellow students. And of course, they have questions themselves. They are often interested in the big questions, like when we look at the universe, what is the meaning of everything? These are questions that are frequently asked by Nobel Prize winning physicists or biologists and so on. So there is really some interest there, I would say, maybe on another level than many other people. And of course, they also need Jesus, because if Jesus is the creator of the universe and the savior of us, then they need the relationship with him. And there are quite a few scientists who are believers in Jesus, and they live a fulfilled life believing in Jesus and being a good scientist. So, my recommendation to everyone who is afraid, don't be afraid, but be interested in them. And if you don't know how to approach them, then just show interest and ask questions. Yeah, you can say something, of course. Yeah, that's the way how we will do it. Peter, with his enormous experience, will sometimes interfere and tell a story or a compliment. Intervention.
Yeah, right. You know, the people scientists are most afraid of are other scientists. Because for a scientist, maybe for other professions too, reputation is something you absolutely need. It's part of your market value and everything. And in science, lots of people are quite vain. Vanity is a very common, unfortunately, a very common thing in science, because we are very often watched by people that are younger than us, so we want to have a good reputation. I remember when I was a PhD student, one of our professors, I had just become a Christian, and I had talked about it in a group seminar, in a research group seminar, working for mechanical phenomenon in nature. So one of our professors, in the lab, back in the lab, we were alone in the lab, at the bench, suddenly told me, look, I also believe in that. But if I tell my colleagues, they will think I'm stupid. So I found out later that he was really a born-again Christian. But he was afraid of other scientists, actually. And the interesting other fact, which is connected to that, is that a little bit later, he asked me to do a certain part of his lecture, which was on drugs of abuse. And I had a lecture where I include the spiritual aspect. Obviously, he didn't want to do that himself. He wanted somebody else to kind of do something which is a little bit beyond the material and purely scientific aspect. So this could even happen to you. If I'm not a scientist, perhaps a scientist would like for you to say what he doesn't want to do in public, and perhaps you can team up with somebody. In that case, it was kind of special, perhaps that was within academia, but just to add what Alexander had explained.
And scientists love to explain their theories to people who are interested, because other scientists often don't listen because they are interested in other theories. So, second chapter, know the foundations, presuppositions in science. Everyone needs to believe in something. Everyone needs to start somewhere. A mathematician has even proven that, Kurt Gödel, that even mathematicians have to believe in some axioms in order to be able to know something in mathematics and that mathematics works at all. So, what does every scientist have to believe in order to do science? He must believe that our mind can understand nature and know the truth. And if you think about today's society, that's not a common notion. A lot of people would say there is no truth out there. At least they would say that, even though I believe actually they think that there is truth, but they would be relativists often. But scientists plainly say there is truth out there, which is a great connection point. And then they would believe that all these complex phenomena that we observe in the cosmos or in the microcosmos, in our body, in living systems, there must be deeper laws behind all that, behind the complex phenomena. And they believe, especially the physicists, not so much the biologists or the chemists, but the physicists, that these laws are somehow simple, so that we can reduce the phenomena of the planets and of the atoms and everything maybe to the law of gravitation and to other simple laws. And that these laws exhibit a certain kind of beauty and that they are comprehensible, that we can understand nature in the language of mathematics. That's something that most scientists would agree on, and that's remarkable because this is not clear from the beginning when you start with and look at nature. For the Greeks, that was not logical that nature should conform to certain rational laws. But of course, while they believe that there is truth, they would often say, well, there are only natural causes. All that there is true is just matter. That's everything. But of course, you can always ask the question, so how can you be sure that there is nothing beyond matter? That's a good question to ask, and then listen what the answer will be. Or you could even ask, couldn't there be mind beyond matter, for example, if you want to be more daring to get into a conversation. So it's good to ask, so what do you know that you also believe something, or what do you believe as a scientist? So if you want to start a conversation, is that it? Yeah. Let's assume here we have the Christian living a happy life, and the scientist is really isolated. Of course, they are also often very happy people, so it's just to distinguish the two. And this is the gospel, Jesus. And we can think about ourselves as being on the same side, because both of us are looking for truth, scientists and Christians. We want to know what is true. And so there is this wall of doubt, of unknowledge, of ignorance. And we must somehow help the scientist or the naturalist to actually have a look at the gospel, at Jesus. And as I told you, I think the starting point is always love. And love means interest. If you are not really interested in another person, then how will you be able to reach that person? If you just pass on a tract, for example, the person might read it or not, might understand it or not, but what will happen? In my experience, the most important thing is really showing interest in people, and then a lot of people will say, wow, I've never had such a good conversation with a Christian on these issues, and you seem to be really interested in what I believe as a scientist or as a naturalist. So that's the basic attitude, I think. And it's interesting to talk to scientists. And then, of course, we must be aware that both of us have worldviews. Like, we must understand the gospel with all the implications. That's why we are here at the ELF, for example. And we also must understand what is the worldview of the person to whom we are talking. I mean, that's true for everyone, not only for scientists. But I love this scheme, which shows how you can engage in meaningful dialogue. So when you ask questions about worldview, I will just show you a few questions in a minute. Then you could find out, okay, where's common ground? And you could confirm the common ground. Instead of just wedging in and saying, no, I believe something completely different, you can first say, okay, that's interesting. Actually, I agree with you that there is truth. And then you could add, but of course, I would say there is more than matter, and it's true that there is more than matter or something. And then you need to challenge the differences. Don't be afraid of that. But first start with confirming common ground. And of course, you could always be wrong with your information or with your arguments. So I've learned a lot by discussing with naturalists in my own arguments, which I can use and which I shouldn't use so much. So I love this model. It's actually taken from a book called Evangelism Made Slightly Less Difficult by Nick Pollard, if you want to look that up. I mean, the graphics is not in the book. That's what happened in my mind to illustrate it. But if you want to read more about that, buy that book. It's not in this bookstore, unfortunately, but you find it in any online bookshop. So what are worldview questions you could ask? And to engage in an interesting philosophical discussion with scientists, and scientists often love these kind of questions, you could ask, what is the ultimate cause for everything? Is it rather mind or is it rather matter? What is a human being? Is it just a chance product of genes shuffling around, being mutated and reproduced? Or do we have a higher meaning, like being made in the image of God? Or what can we know? How can we be sure that we can know anything in nature, for example? And why can we know something? What should we do? Where do we get our morals from? And then a scientist might have a hard time. How can we know what we should do? Is there morals? Why should we all not kill other human beings, for example? And what is our destiny? Where are we going to? Do we have hope? And if you're a naturalist, there is not much hope, unfortunately. So that's also a good point to talk about, if you want to. And then often there is this notion that when you discuss with someone that you should give a conclusive proof for the existence of God. Like, you know, you believe in God, I'm a scientist, I believe only what I see. So please show me, where is your God? Prove that God exists. And so the question is the burden on proof on my side or on his side? So the best answer to that question would be, so what would count as a proof for you if I tell you anything? And then second, is there a conclusive proof of God's non-existence? Can you prove to me that he does not exist? And how should that work? So don't accept the burden of proof only on your side, but also ask for proofs on the other side. And then if we cannot be sure that God exists or does not exist from a scientific point of view, then why should we exclude God from the beginning? in explaining reality. If we cannot be sure that there is a God or no God, then we should be open for both alternatives, to start from a rather neutral point and not take a point and assuming something that we cannot be sure about. And then, what I always try also in my talks is, I would say, there is no proof for or against God's existence, but what we can do is we can compare the plausibility of God's existence or of his non-existence. So it's like when you ask the question, is it plausible that my girlfriend or my boyfriend will be a faithful wife or husband in the future? There is no proof that this will be the case, of course. But you could still find out about the character while you date and while you get to know each other, and you will get some evidence, and at some point you will be persuaded and say, yes, I want to marry that person because I'm persuaded, I have enough evidence. And it might be similar with God when you look around all the evidence that we have, that there is evidence that makes it more plausible that there is God or that there is no God. But ultimately, we are free to make our decision because there is no conclusive proof. But we would be stupid not to compare the two alternatives if we cannot be sure about the answer of this very important question in our life. So these are the two worldviews, and either spirit or mind is primary and creates matter, or matter is primary and by some material processes spirit or mind come into existence. Either one or the other one. These are the two worldviews, and the conflict is between these two worldviews, either theism, like theos means God in Greek, or materialism. And then, what science can do, science will never prove one or the other, but you can always ask the question, so where does science fit better? The method of science that is applied to understand nature, and the results of science. And this helps already to set the stage a bit, like, okay, let's be fair, I take that worldview, you take that worldview, and let's compare. Is it more plausible that matter is the ultimate cause for everything, or is it more plausible that mind is the ultimate cause for everything? Okay. So, you can compliment.
Just three things. For one, if you return one slide, please. In my present department, I have had the most interesting conversations with a colleague who's an outspoken atheist, and once I asked him, why is it that you want to discuss these things with me? And he said, well, you're sure about your worldview and I am sure about my worldview. People that are not sure where they stand find it difficult to discuss their worldview with anybody. So if you encounter a person that has, for example, a strongly atheist position, that's perhaps a person you can talk to. I mean, as yet he hasn't moved away from his standpoint of view, but still. Number two, quite unrelated to what I just said, science is about details. Real scientists care a lot about detail. So if you want to engage with a scientist in a conversation which goes a little bit more deeply, be prepared that they want to know details, because that's what we work with. It's called facts in other circumstances. Little facts which add up to something. And thirdly, if you are not a scientist, if you happen not to be a scientist, this could actually help to talk to a scientist. I remember I talked to a colleague a couple of years ago, and anyway, we had struck up quite a relationship. And then we talked about a particular thing which, to my mind, points to the existence of a created something from chemistry, homochirality, which I don't want to explain now. But he reacted by saying, but hasn't so-and-so published something about it, which clarifies the situation. Actually, so-and-so had published nothing about it. But the conversation between two scientists could get stuck on quoting authorities, or not really listening to each other, or saying like, okay, this fact or problem which you've just addressed, this is for the mathematicians. I'm a chemist, I can't talk about it. So the conversation between two scientists that wants to move into spiritual matters could get stuck on the details. And if you're not, if you don't know about the details, just know that they matter, you can perhaps sidestep this blind alley and talk to the scientist about something which is nearer to his heart. But of course, he has to open to that. Remember the quote which Alexander put in this presentation by Peter Atkins, pure sentiment. Well, I think that sentiment is a very good rationalization of a lot of things. But obviously, for him, Peter Atkins, science counts more than sentiments, which is a weird way of defining humanity. You find many scientists that get stuck on this strange approach to themselves and to other people.
Thank you. So let's come to the third chapter, Know the Limits, the Scope of Science. If someone claims that science has disproven the existence of God, then the person does not even understand their own method, I would say. Because science works empirically. So you state a thesis, a theory. For example, you can say cats love to eat goldfish. And you see 1,000 times cats eating goldfish. And then you come to this pool and you make a new observation. This goldfish has eaten a cat. So this obviously is a challenge for your theory. You need to test again, or you need to revise your theory. And that's how science works all the time, of course, a bit more sophisticated with the theories. But you try to summarize observations, try to find out the regularity, and then you test this prediction, this regularity prediction, against other evidence. And you can never conclusively say that it will never be disproven, because there will always be new evidence, and the next experiment could be the one that refutes your theory. And by the way, science can never disprove the existence of anything, because there can always be new evidence. I mean, we are quite sure that there is no perpetuum mobile, because up to now all of these theories have been refuted, and there are some theoretical arguments, but we can never really be sure that there is a perpetuum mobile, for example. So a self-moving thing without losing energy. So many scientists would rather say, yeah, okay, of course, I agree, we can't disprove the existence of God. But they would say, but science has made the notion of God superfluous. And then you could always say, of course, you are right. God is not the direct explanation for thunder and for lightning, for example, as the Greeks believed Zeus would throw thunder and lightning on the earth. Yes, science has made that superfluous by knowing how such a thunder and lightning comes into place by charges that are removed from water droplets. But the bigger question is always going away from these detailed processes. Is the world as a whole, is it self-explanatory, as a product of matter only? It would be the same question, and I like to ask that question to scientists who come up with that argument, and ask them, if you see a nice picture, a painting of Van Gogh, do you find Van Gogh in his painting? Even if he has painted himself in that painting. Is he in that picture? No, he's not. And still we believe that he authored that picture and that he exists. And the same is true about nature. Like Yuri Gagarin, he said, I went into space and I didn't see God there. But would you expect to see God personally in his work if he is the creator of that work? And I would say no, of course not. If you would see God within nature, then he is a part of nature and not beyond nature. Of course, a creator could always choose to become a part of nature, as Jesus is the incarnate God, but God is always bigger somehow than just this revelation in Jesus. The Father is still there, and beyond the Son even. So yes, we can find traces of God, for example, his intelligence or his sense for beauty or something like that, within his picture, within nature. But we will not find him personally in a piece of rock, for example. And then the second point about this is, often people say, like, we have discovered a mechanism, let's say evolution, for example, and hence we don't need any God anymore because the mechanism explains everything. But when you ask, why is the water in the kettle boiling? Then you could say, yeah, because there is heat generated by electric currents or by coal, whatever kind of stove you use. And then the water warms up and it reaches a phase transition and evaporates in the end. So that's why the water in the kettle is boiling. But you could as well say, well, I want to have a cup of tea, and so I switched on the stove. So the mechanisms in physics and chemistry do not refute that there is someone who switched on the stove and wants to drink a cup of tea. So a personal explanation of an author does not contradict necessarily a mechanistic explanation. It's the same if you ask how are computers produced, and they are produced completely in machine manufacturers, like without human beings doing anything there. Would that prove that there is no one who constructed the computers in the beginning or who invented the computers? Like would Bill Gates be refuted when we understand how a computer works and how a computer is constructed? So the argument is, if you discover a mechanism, that does not show that there is no author. But just the other way around, if you discover and understand a mechanism, that could even mean that you have more appreciation for the creator. Like Kepler was amazed when he discovered the order in the planetary movement, and he praised God for that. He did not say, now I understand how they move, there is no God. No, just the other way around, interestingly. So mechanism does not refute an author. And then third, often scientists would say, science has shown that religions are just myths, and science is the only way to truth. And then I would say, just with my little scheme before, yes, you're right to some degree. Science has really demystified a lot in the world. By explaining the thunder, for example, or planetary motions by purely natural mechanisms. The stars are no gods, as the Babylonians and many people in antiquity believed. They are just matter. And the interesting thing is that the Bible claims the same. It also demystifies the world of the other cultures who believe that there are thousands of gods there. It says sun and stars are just lamps. So science and the Bible are quite in the same direction. It's just that naturalists often go one god further, as they say. They don't stop with one god, but they say there is no god. But wait a minute. To eliminate a lot of different gods is a different thing than to think whether there is an ultimate origin to the universe that is mind or personal, or whether it's matter that is responsible for everything. And so if you ask about different things like moral values, as we will see in a minute, or beauty or meaning or freedom, then these questions are not accessible with scientific means. You need philosophy for that and many other disciplines. It would be the same as if you try to understand your spouse by weighing and measuring how tall he or she is, and try to understand the mind of your spouse in that way, by physics only. That does not work. You need to talk with her or with him. So science is limited because of its method. Do you want to add anything to that? Because now we come to the fourth chapter.
Yes, exactly. This was about the scope and limits of science. So I think it's a truism that science has limits. This is not anything you have to convince a scientist of, because he will know that her science has methodical limits. But scientists, naturalistic scientists, will think that it's just a matter of time and the limits will be pushed further. So what you want to show is that there is something outside the scope of science which is real. You want to show that there are sources of knowledge which science cannot fully make use of. A couple of years ago, I co-organized a talk on the resurrection of Jesus in my university. Actually, I had invited Gary Habermas, who was a speaker in this forum a couple of years ago from the US, to do that. And afterwards, I was attacked in my faculty. Why did you cooperate with organizing something so unscientific? So the simple answer is that this was not unscientific. It was about history, historical aspects. Actually, in our language, in German, we have just one word for science and humanities. It's something like knowledge. So it's a different source of knowledge which Professor Habermas used to show the plausibility. It's just the plausibility if you address the question scientifically, historically, scientifically, to show the very high possibility that Jesus indeed rose from the dead. So I think the thing is that you want to show there is something outside the scope, there is an absolute limit, and again, I think this is a truism, like Alexander has explained by what he explained to the last lines of his slide.
Okay, so science has limits, and we can connect to that. And now, what are questions how we can connect to scientists? I like this one. Like, you could ask a scientist, so do you believe that we can understand nature with our mind? And every scientist would say, yes, of course, we do that. We do that in science. So then my question to you is, if our thinking is just the product of something else, like only my neurons that are firing, necessity, natural laws, chance, blind chance, or like the survival of the fittest, which somehow might have created my brain in evolutionary theory. So if that is the case, why should we trust our logic to be true? Why should we trust our thinking if our thinking is caused by natural processes? Because then you could always say, like, I have no reason to trust any theory because your atoms made you believe your theory. And my atoms, unfortunately, make me not to believe your theory, if you understand what I mean. And that's just to challenge. And this is actually an acknowledged problem in philosophy of materialism. That in materialism, we don't have a basis to believe our thoughts to be true. And you just have to assume it. That for some reasons, natural processes arrived at our mind to be able to understand reality and develop true models of reality. And that is one of the reasons why there are so many constructivists today who believe that we are not able to understand truth and that it's just all relative and we make it up in our own minds and maybe it's all an illusion. And it gets even further to solipsism, that it's only me who exists or a brain or something. So another thing is, why are there rational laws in nature? This is the problem of mathematical language in nature. Like Albert Einstein, this is a very nice quotation. He said, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. So just the other way, like Socrates. Socrates said, I know, I don't know. And he says, I know something, but I don't know why. Mathematics is an object of mind, of thoughts. So there is no reason why matter should conform to a mathematical pattern. And mathematics is very powerful. For example, mathematics predicted that there must be antimatter when they did some calculations in quantum mechanics and special relativity. And so they tried to set up an experiment, and 3 years later, in 1932, they found out, yes, there is antimatter. So it's amazing, and it's a puzzle to all the big Nobel Prize winners. Eugene Wigner wrote a paper about that, Albert Einstein and many others, and I discussed with an atheist in a symposium, and he said this is the strongest argument in his view against materialism, and so he's open for some kind of Platonism, that there are mathematical structures that work somehow into matter. The Christian Science pioneers, they were persuaded that we must find rational law in nature because there is a lawgiver like Johannes Kepler, Copernicus, and Newton. Newton considered his discovery of the law of gravity as a proof of the existence of God because it would summarize so well how the world would work and how gravity keeps everything together. And this is actually the basis for our universities. Truth in three books: God's revelation, God's work, nature, and God's thoughts, our reason. And we are made in the image of God, and so we share a bit in his reason, even though our thoughts are smaller. And this is veritas, truth in Latin. And we discover veritas in three books. That's the Harvard University beacon, by the way. So a lot of universities where science is done were founded by committed Christians. So now we get into some science, like cosmology. Why does the universe exist at all? That's always a good question to ask to a scientist. It's the problem of the origin of the universe. And you could make the following argument. Like, everything that has a beginning has a cause. We apply that in science all the time, actually. Something that is not there forever, but starts at some point in time, must be caused by something else. I mean, there are some exceptions to that in quantum mechanics, which seems to have some chance events. But generally, we believe that. And then there is a lot of evidence that the universe has a beginning. And so if that is true, then the question is, what caused the universe? If the universe has a beginning, it must have a cause. So if it's a cause that is not part of the universe, this cause must be beyond space, beyond time, beyond matter, because otherwise this cause would be part of the universe and the universe would not really have a cause. And it must be effective somehow. And while mathematical numbers are beyond space, time, and matter, they are usually not effective of moving anything. But the will of a person, for example, and I say I want to raise my hand, this, interestingly, is effective with matter. So a good candidate for a cause for the universe is a person with a mind and with intentionality. And the interesting thing is now, if you look at what scientists say, like this is a naturalist, John Gribben. He writes in Nature, right after some of the biggest evidence for the beginning of the universe was discovered, the microwave background. He says the biggest problem with the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe is philosophical, perhaps even theological. What was there before the Big Bang? And Arno Penzias, he's a Jew, as far as I know, and he got the Nobel Prize for discovering the cosmic microwave background. He says, the best data we have concerning the Big Bang are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. What a statement by a Nobel Prize winner. I mean, whether you are a young Earth creationist, old Earth creationist, or theistic evolutionist, or whatever you believe, these are statements by respected scientists, and it shows that actually naturalists have a problem with the beginning of the universe, and that theists who believe in a personal creator have no problem with the data about a beginning of the universe. And then when we study the universe even further, and would you be up for a little movie clip, 5 minutes? Just as a refreshment, because then I can give you this argument also via a movie that we have produced. It's called Our Fascinating Universe, and we have John Lennox in that movie, for example, and Alistair McGrath and some German scientists who are all active in academia. So the DVD needs to load.
Of the fundamental forces of nature must have exactly defined values in order that the universe does not expand too fast after the Big Bang. Then stars could never form because they are drifting apart too fast. Conversely, if the universe collapsed too fast, there would be too little time for the formation of stars and galaxies.
This can be demonstrated by a ball
hovering in an airstream. If the airstream is too weak, the ball drops. If it's too strong, it flies away. In the same way as the weight of the ball must be in balance by the strength of the airstream in order to keep the ball hovering at its position. The fundamental forces of nature must be balanced. This is a basic prerequisite for the existence of life.
The very narrow limits arise, for example, in the correlation of gravity and the force which has been driving apart the universe. Of course, we know well that gravity causes matter to attract matter, causing condensation of matter, while we know very little about the force which has driven it apart. Regarding the origin of the Big Bang, there are only speculations. But one should consider how well-adjusted the two forces must be, that the universe has evolved the way in which it has, so that life could emerge.
How accurate must this adjustment of the two forces be? How tolerant is the universe against deviations from this ratio to still allow for our existence?
This adjustment was estimated to a precision of 1 to 10 to the power of 60. That is a 1 of 60 zeros. Hardly imaginable. For comparison, this would correspond to the probability that when I position a coin at the edge of the universe and try to shoot at it, I hit it. The probability is low, in fact, exactly this factor of 10 to the power of 60. The adjustment is necessary so that the universe expands on the one hand, but allows for local condensation of galaxies stars and planets on the other hand. Today we notice that the universe as a whole, with its fundamental characteristics, is arranged in such a way that all this could happen. When these fundamental constants are changed, it all flies apart or can't exist at all. Hence, we would probably have no stars anymore, and no galaxies, no dust. Life could not be supported. It is commonly held that nature is tolerant against little variations. We think that we can afford a little pollution on Earth, but then we must back it. But with the universe, this is different. If we change the universe with its parameters, it doesn't work.
Let's compare this situation with cracking a vault. We will succeed only if all numbers of the code are adjusted exactly. The situation with the fundamental forces of the universe is similar. They must conform within narrow limits, as they actually are, in order to allow for organic life. This is consensus among scientists. However, whether in fact a solar system and a life-supporting planet can come into being in this universe is still a very different question.
So I will stop here. I think you got the argument. It's amazing. Scientists did not expect that. But the more research work was done on the parameters of our universe, the more we found out, wow, they are really fine-tuned so that we can exist. And if you change a little bit, there would be no atoms or no stars or nothing at all. And it's not just one parameter, but it's hundreds. And so that's like cracking this vault. Everything must fit, otherwise the door will not open. Then life itself. I mean, there is a whole talk that Peter Imming has on Focal Online, by the way, on the origin of life. Sorry?
It was taken. I had it taken away.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it was there. But you gave it, yeah. And so for me, the most fascinating thing is, where does information come from when you look at life? No one had expected that 100 years ago that there would be a molecule that stores information in a coded algorithmic way, like having letters that build words, and there is a code like with a language. It's amazing if you think about that. And that's why it was called hereditary information. It's no chance that it was called that way. So when you go to another planet and you find a system where two chemicals are mapped onto each other in an algorithmic coded way, what would you think? Do you think that was just a chance process on that planet, or would you think there is some intelligence on that planet? I would probably go for the last. So that's a big question. If you find information, isn't that an argument that there is an intelligent sender? I mean, that's what you learn at school, actually, when you deal with information theory and communication theory. So that's a good question to ask. And then one point that is often made is, and it would be a different lecture, of course, does biological evolution refute God's existence? Often people say, like, evolution is a fact. It explains why there are human beings and everything, and hence there is no God. But the big question is, again, why could God not establish a mechanism for life to adapt? Mechanism versus author, as a reminder that we had before. So in our network, in the science network, we have people who believe, yes, evolution is the mechanism by which God created the world. Of course, we have other people who say, well, the problem is evolution is not a fact. But if you're not a specialist, it's maybe difficult to argue, to go into the details. But you could just say, you know, it's not that way that evolution proves there is no God, but it's the other way. If you are an atheist, then you have only one choice. It must be evolution. So for the atheist, it must be evolution. There is no other choice. The proof is that even the Greek philosophers like Epicurus, Lucretius, and so on, they had already an evolutionary theory, if you look at that. And of course, we must admit variation in selection can be observed, like antibiotical resistance of bacteria. And we see that new species arise, like Darwin's finches, for example. But the big, big question in evolution is actually, how do purposeful building plans arise by chance, like an eye or a feather? Or Andy McIntosh will give a workshop on the wonder of hearing tomorrow, I think. So if you are interested in that, go to that workshop. And why do you see the same construction principles used by intelligent engineers and by so-called blind evolution? I show you the next slide. This is a molecule in your cells. It produces the energy packages that are used up in the cell. They are called ATP, but don't worry about the details. Scientists do. And then you compare it to a turbine, how electricity is produced. You will find out that there are similar principles. Like you have a stator, you have a rotor that rotates within the stator. Here, this is in the cell wall, a stator. And then you have a flux medium, which flows through the cell wall, or here through the turbine, and which drives it to rotate. And while it rotates, by some really complicated mechanisms, there is electricity or energy produced, which is amazing. You see that actually engineers, without knowing what happens in our cells, built a similar thing by thinking about it. So did nature think about that? It's interesting that even Richard Dawkins says biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So he admits, yes, the appearance is there. I just claim, he has no proof for that, this is just the illusion, this appearance. You want to add?
Yes. Just two or three comments at this point. For one, try to argue not from ignorance. You want to tell people why you believe in God. Try to argue from knowledge, from what science or some other knowledge source has provided. That is ever so important, because we're not Christians because we know so little, do we? We are Christians because we believe to know something, namely that Jesus died for us, which is, of course, not a scientific argument as such, but again, we argue from knowledge, not from ignorance. And another thing in this connection, I sometimes find that arguments that might convince a scientist of the truth of theism or of the Bible, some of the arguments that convince the scientist or that matter for scientists, quite different from what lay people find convincing. And that could really create problems. I was asked to support a missionary outreach in a city nearby where I live, and they wanted to put up posters that most of them were kind of, the Bible has known it all the time. So the Bible knew about everything that science actually only discovered during the past several hundred years. So I said, I can't do this. I can't do this because the Bible doesn't include all scientific knowledge that has since been discovered. But they found that really, really convincing. So I just stayed away. Unfortunately, we could not cooperate. And you will find that in other other topics too, like Alexander explained about the Big Bang. And I know quite a number of Christians that kind of think the Big Bang is like an invention by bad people to argue against the Bible, but they don't understand what we've just listened to, that this creates a big problem. There was an absolute beginning that creates a problem not for Christians, but for naturalists. It's just a matter of how do you understand the Big Bang in somewhat more detail. So what I want to say is that please try to have a look, if you want to go into a discussion that includes scientific aspects, have a look at argument, counter-argument, counter-counter-argument. There is some depth in this discussion. And I remember that we watched the John Lennox-Richard Dawkins debate, which he had a couple of years ago, with physicists, some of them Christians. And to my big surprise, and it could have been any other scientific branch, to my big surprise, I understood that this discussion for them was kind of, they didn't really understand. They didn't see the points of either person. And that was because both Richard Dawkins and John Lennox know their stuff, no matter what we think about Richard Dawkins, he knows his stuff. And they were kind of arguing at a level which, when you first encounter the material, think about it, you haven't yet reached. So if you want to go into something like this, try to think about, what does this argument actually prove? Who does it help? Fast speciation in biology. Who does this argument serve? Creationists or naturalists? It's not an easy thing. It needs some thinking, perhaps a few minutes, sometimes perhaps a couple of days.
Or can it be interpreted by both?
Exactly.
By the way, if you want to see the whole movie, it's available in the bookstore. It's called Our Fascinating Universe, if you are interested. Okay, so of course, the topic is much larger, but just to leave it like that, you could always ask this question, why are these principles applied in nature that are also applied by intelligent engineers? Or migrating birds. I just love this one. This East Siberian golden plover traveling from Alaska to Hawaii, 4,500 kilometers, and he knows how to orient according to the stars and to the magnetic field. He has some organs about that. And he optimizes his energy intake. So he just takes enough energy that when flying together with other birds in a wedge structure, the bird will have enough energy to reach Hawaii after 88 hours. But if he flew alone, he would fall into the sea after about 70 hours, which is about here. And there is no island about around Hawaii where he could just land and find some food or something. So he must reach Hawaii. So I don't know why that bird flies doesn't fly to Mexico. Maybe because there are too many mafia bosses or something. I'm not sure. But he just flies to Hawaii. Maybe it's nicer. I don't know. But it's really interesting how optimized and how wonderful this flight of migration birds is. And I think every Lufthansa and every airline could learn a lot from this kind of flight and how they plan it and do it. Now, we come to the end. One of the most interesting topics that right now causes a lot of upheaval, especially after Thomas Nagel's book, Mind and Cosmos, is consciousness. Is consciousness just a function of neurons? How can matter, dead matter, like we consist of atoms, how can they come to a point where they experience images, thoughts, an identity, I am I, or can feel anything? Like it starts with feelings even, like pain and so on. These experiences are only accessible to the self. I know what I feel when you step on my foot. I can only extrapolate that you might feel a similar thing, but I will never know whether you feel a similar thing. Like when you see red, it might be a completely different color than when I say I see red. We just point to the same object that we were told to be. It's red over there, that bar.
Is it?
Yeah, I would say. Is mind just a function of matter? And I love to compare that to a TV. Is the TV program, I mean, we had this question last night, and the boy answered like, have you ever seen thoughts, for example? And I would say, is the TV program explained by the electrical currents of the TV? So this is my cat watching an ice bear in the TV program. She was really enthusiastic about that ice bear. Polar bear, it's not called ice bear, it's ice bear in German. And you could even prove that when you destroy the TV, there is no program anymore, there is no polar bear anymore. So obviously the polar bear is just contained in the circuits of the TV program, of the hardware of the TV. But of course we know that the program in the TV is much more than just the wiring in the TV. It's only transmitted via that. And so also consciousness might just be something that goes on some hardware, but is actually caused by an immaterial soul. And I really like that, and I think that helps a lot of people to see that neuroscience will never be able to refute the existence of a soul. If you want to know more about that, there's another movie coming up tonight. here tonight, showing in room 3-2. We produced that last year at 9:15. If you are too tired, don't worry. The DVD is also available in the bookstore for 5 euros instead of, or 6 euros instead of 14 euros. So a last point that you could ask a scientist is, can moral values be explained by evolutionary variation and selection? This is the approach which was discussed by Richard Weikart in our network, for example. And the problem is the following. C.S. Lewis has written in it in his essay, The Abolition of Man. So if you can get a hold of that, you will understand this. If moral values are simply the arbitrary product of instinct, of sentiments, of emotions, and of survival of the fittest, which is underneath our instincts and emotions, so why should we follow them? If one instinct tells me, eat this cake, and the other instinct tells me, look at that poor lady over there, she looks really very thin and so on, she might need that cake even more. Which instinct should I follow? The one or the other one? And how do I decide? Is it just the strength of the instincts, and how should that be morals then? And it might in one second be one side, and another second another side. So in evolution, what we see is we have variation and selection. And selection will eliminate the bad variations. So it's actually great if you have different people with different morals in evolution, because then you can select for the best morals. And then there will never be absolute values like human rights, which of course is a big threat to our society. If we have no reason, no foundation, no rational foundation why there are human rights, if that's just a convention of human beings, like we have discussed it and we want that human beings have special rights and dignity, if that's just a convention, it just is a question who will win the next war, whether there will be these rights or not, if they are not absolute. And of course, the big question behind that is, if there is no transcendent, eternal judge, then there is no justice. Because if we die and are just dead and become atoms again, matter dispersed in the universe somewhere, why should we care about our lives today? So we really only have reasons to believe in absolute values to which we have to be responsible and which we have to follow if there is a transcendent eternal judge. And this is connected to our question of destiny. And of course, there is only a small step towards the gospel if you meet that judge. So at that point, I would just refer to some readings for you, like John Lennox has Science Buried God, or William Lane Craig, Reasonable Faith, is downstairs in the bookstore. Or as I mentioned, Nick Pollard, Evangelism Made Slightly Less Difficult. And then there are quite a few websites. For example, bethinking.org, they have a lot of talks on that from different views. And in German, we have our institute's website, Institut für Glaube und Wissenschaft. I think I need to say it here. Peter is also involved as a volunteer in that institute. And we have a website for younger people where we have videos and audios and short texts, begründetglauben.org. But it's all in German. So, thank you very much. Now,